You're listening to a 95BFM podcast.
You're tuned into The Wire. 1 hour of current affairs and analysis starting now.
Tēnā koutou katoa, ko Joel toku ingoa, nō mai haere mai ki te wai mō tēnei rā. Kia ora and welcome to The Wire for Rāpare Thursday. My name is Joel and I'm your host for today, covering for Caden, and I'll be with you for the next hour. I'm joined by producer Sarah. E whai ake nei, coming up on the show, for our weekly catch-up with the Labour Party, I spoke to MP Shannon Halbert about the re-establishment of 10 polytechnics that were previously merged under Te Pukenga, and Te Pāti Māori members accusing the party of being greedy for running MP Pini Hinare in the upcoming Tamaki Makaurau by-election. I spoke to Tom Wilkinson, a PhD candidate in history at the University of Auckland, about Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu nominating US President Donald Trump for a Nobel Peace Prize. For International Desk, Wire host Caden spoke to Natasha Linsout from the University of Essex on the backslide of democracy in Georgia, particularly due to Russian influence and the public response. Sarah, what do you have for us today?
For this week's City Counselling, I spoke with Councillor Julie Ferry about her recent biking accident and her hopes for road safety in Auckland, as well as the recently released State of the City report. And on Monday, producer Sam spoke to Peter Adams, a professor in the School of Population Health at the University of Auckland, about the government's alcohol levy in light of recent lobbying by the alcohol industry.
Hea aho whakaro. I would love to hear your thoughts on any of these pieces, so get in touch. Tuku pātuhi mai, text it on 5395, or waiamai rānei, give us a call in studio on 309 3879. Kaua e wareware e ahei ana koto, te whakarongo ki e nei kōrero anō, hei pakihiri rokiroki maurongi i te pai, tukutuku o Irirangi Pōho, me Heidi Key, 95BFM, irakati.com. You can catch all these stories by podcast on the 95BFM website, 95BFM.com.
It's time for our weekly catch-up with the Labour Party.
The government has announced that Te Pukenga is set to return to regional governance, re-establishing 10 polytechnics that were merged under the previous Labour-led government. In 2020, under the previous Labour-led government, 16 polytechnics and 9 industry training organisations were merged into the mega-institute Te Pukenga as a head office. Despite this, the polytechnics were allowed to maintain their unique images and continue operating. Vocational Education Minister Penny Simmons announced the move to establish a vocational education system that is locally led, regionally responsible, and future-focused. The move has faced backlash. The Tertiary Education Union's National Secretary, Sandra Gray, says the move would be a disaster for regional education and that the sector is being treated as a political football. For our weekly catch-up with the Labour Party, I spoke with MP Shannon Halbert about this move from the government. We also discussed Te Pāti Māori members expressing concerns over Labour's choice of running MP Pini Hinare in the upcoming Tamaki Makaurau by-election. Te Pāti Māori media liaison Kiri Tamihere Waititi says a vote for Hinare would be wasted as Hinare already has a seat in Parliament. She has called for people to vote for Te Pāti Māori's candidate, Orini Kaipara, so that there would be 2 Tamaki Makaurau-based Māori MPs in Parliament. But first, we discussed vocational education. How are the Labour Party feeling about this move?
Well, the move that the Minister has made is to cut jobs in order to reach financial viability. She's promised a regional polytechnic model that she can't afford, and she refuses to provide the financial information available to her to tell us that it stacks up.
Prime Minister Christopher Luxon says that Labour's reforms created a model that was too centralised and too removed from local communities. Is this true?
Well, the reality is that she's taken us backwards to establish a polytechnic sector that was never financially viable. And so the development of Te Pukenga was to create a more sustainable financial environment and to ensure that equity of access to learning was available to all of our communities across Aotearoa, that's not the plan that she's put up.
Speaking more to that equity of learning, how will this impact more rural communities?
Well, the reality is, as you'll see in other media reported, that institutions like Toihoho Mai are having to close their Tokoroa and Taupo campuses and reduce the provision offered in places like Rotorua. Those are some of our most remote campuses, and that leaves them only having online options to learn. North Tech, of course, has had to close courses up in Kaikohe and Kaitaia, and they are downsizing and moving campus from their Whangarei campus as well. So it means less courses available for young people in those areas. It means job cuts. There's already been hundreds of job cuts already, and I've been asking the Minister how many more as a result of her plan.
Recently, documents obtained under the Official Information Act by the spin-off show the Mega Institute has lost over $80 million in funding and 1 in 10 staff following being prepared to be split. What impact will this move have heading forward for the future of polytechnics?
We'll see more job cuts as a result of Penny Simmons' plan moving forward and less options available to the regions. She has promised that she'll give back regional independence, but actually she's offered up a more expensive model that she can't afford.
If the Labour Party were to get into government, how would the party address polytechnics heading forward?
Well, equity of access is very, very important. We've got to make sure that learners and young people in places like Tokoroa have the same opportunities available to them in places like Tāmaki, Makaurau, Auckland. It's important that the tertiary sector reflects this and that we're doing the work at government and policy level to make this provision available for them.
As well as this, some Te Pāti Māori members have expressed concerns over the party's choice to enter the upcoming Tāmaki Makaurau by-election with MP Pini Hinare, which was prompted by the passing of Te Pāti Māori MP Takutai Kemp. Te Pāti Māori's media liaison, Kiri Tamihere Waititi, has called the decision greedy and would be a wasted vote, as Hinare is already represented in Parliament. Is this decision, as Te Pāti Māori puts it, greedy?
Certainly not. I have high expectations for our people in Tāmaki Makaurau, and it's important that in a by-election they have choice. Pēni Hinare is the best man for the job. He has a proven track record in building houses in our city, in supporting hauora and whānau order, making sure that our whānau have better health provision available to them. And so, you know, it's a challenging time under this government, and so we need the best person for the job that can advocate for the things that matter, but most of all, achieve the outcomes that Māori need in jobs, health and homes.
Te Pāti Māori President John Tamihere told the Herald that Hinare would lose leadership aspirations by running in the by-election. How does the Labour Party feel about this claim?
Well, JT will have his own views about this by-election. What's most important here is that we get out to our whānau across Tāmaki Makaurau, that we communicate the things that we can achieve, both under Labour but also having Pēni Hinare as the MP for Tāmaki Makaurau, to make sure that they feel represented in Parliament, and most of all, they have the outcomes that they need when it comes to warm, dry house, access to health, and that our tamariki are learning in good environments.
Could a move like this damage the potential for a future coalition government with Te Pāti Māori?
If anyone's seen Marae politics, this is quite normal. Labour will be putting up a good fight against Te Pāti Māori in this, but we've been very clear. The focus is about changing the government in 2026, and as I said, that it's important that we have a strong MP in place in Tāmaki Makaurau with a proven track record to take it to the government next year in 2026.
And what would be different with Labour MP Pini Hinare in the Tāmaki Makaurau seat as opposed to Te Pāti Māori's candidate Orini Kaipara?
Well, we'll focus on the things that matter for our whānau and ensuring that we continue to achieve outcomes for them in the areas of jobs, health and homes. These are the areas that people are really, really struggling at the moment. And while the Te Tiriti kaupapa is very important and raising the number of people speaking Te Reo Māori, the reality is that our people are challenged by the cost of living. They're struggling to get by day to day, and so we need a person that's going to actually achieve outcomes for them.
That was Labour's Shannon Halbert on updates regarding Te Pukenga and Te Pāti Māori's reaction to Labour running MP Pini Hinare as a candidate for Tamaki Makaurau in the upcoming by-election.
That was our weekly chat with the Labour Party.
Now, tell me about your father.
City Counselling on 95BFM, our weekly chat with the good people of Auckland Council.
On the 25th of June, our regular City Counselling guest Julie Ferry was involved in a road collision while she was biking in her local area. Ferry wrote about the close call in a piece published in The Spin-off as a reinvigoration of her previous advocacy around the need for road safety measures that improve how safely and efficiently Aucklanders can get around the city. As well, this week we've seen the release of the State of the City report, which compares Auckland on metrics including opportunity and prosperity, culture and experience, place and connectivity, innovation and knowledge, and resilience and sustainability. The report found that we are falling behind other cities, with the biggest emphasis placed on our poor economic productivity in comparison with similar locations. I spoke with Julie Ferry about both of these topics, firstly by asking her what motivated her to write about her recent collision.
I think, basically, I want to help people to understand the impact that these kinds of accidents have. You know, this is not one that will actually make the statistics in terms of being what we call a DSI, a death or serious injury. Because I won't have permanent disability, it doesn't count as a serious injury, it's only a moderate injury. Nonetheless, you know, I can't walk. I won't be able to even start trying to walk for another 3 weeks, which will be the 6 week mark since the accident. And so I wanted to outline for people, hey, these are the consequences of what was effectively a boring mistake made by a driver during rush hour. That meant that they hit me with their car and I flew off my bike and had broken my leg. And so I wanted to sort of tell that story of, hey, yeah, these are the impacts for me personally, but then also that all flows out in terms of having system impacts too. You know, it disrupted traffic on the day. Yeah, obviously there's been a drain on the health service, which continues. Yeah, I had an in-person physio come and visit me yesterday. There's a whole bunch of ACC equipment I have to help me get around the house and things like that. So I wanted to sort of tell that broader story of hopefully people can read what's happened to me and go, oh, hang on a second, yeah, these are accidents do matter and we do need to minimise them. We need to minimise the impacts when they happen, but we also need to hopefully stop them from happening in the first place and to sort of close that gap, because I see a lot of people expressing sympathy and empathy about worse accidents as well as my own experience, but actually there are system changes we can make that will lessen the impact of these accidents, lessen the impact that they happen in the first place. And we need to close that gap there and go, okay, I care about this happening to the individual, actually here's some changes I can support that would make it less likely this would happen in the future. And that's really why I wrote the article, was to hopefully get people who perhaps haven't seen it up close to understand, hey, this is what it is like for people. Yeah, and I mean, I'm in a lot of pain this week. I haven't had a lot of pain up till now, which has been very fortunate. And so that in turn is limiting my capacity to do my job. And so I also wanted my constituents to understand I'm not as available as I might otherwise be at the moment, for pretty good reasons.
What are some of the specific changes you have advocated for or would advocate for in regard to ensuring that Aucklanders aren't deterred by safety risks from modes of transport like cycling?
I think the big one for me is lower speed. This was a relatively low speed crash because the person was turning a corner. They had slowed down to take the corner and, you know, they were probably going a little bit faster than maybe I might have gone turning that corner, I don't know. I couldn't really entirely judge their speed. It happened quite quickly. But if they'd been going faster, I probably wouldn't be having this conversation with you. I'm acutely aware of that, that in a lot of ways I was very lucky. And also if I had been a smaller person, if the car had hit me directly as opposed to hitting the bicycle, which then threw me off, then, yeah, we'd be having either a we wouldn't be talking at all today, or we wouldn't be talking for a few more months, you know. So that's something I'm really aware of is the speed stuff, and that's something I have been advocating for really strongly. I guess the other thing is that would have had an impact on this particular accident is those safe routes to cycle lanes. One of the things so I was just up the road from my house. There's no cycle lanes directly around my house, but I live not too far from some bike lanes and infrastructure. Now, I don't use that to go to work in the city, which is what I was doing, because they don't go in the right direction for me to get to the city, but also I can't get from my house to those bike lanes. You know, it's safer for me, currently has been, to go on the normal road to get to the Dominion Road bus lanes, which are actually pretty good for me. I'm comfortable, lots of people aren't. Double-decker buses are scary. That for me has been a better option. But, you know, my mum doesn't want me to ride a bike ever again, but if I do, she wants me to only ride in cycle lanes. Well, I can't get to the cycle lanes from my house. So, you know, that effectively cuts out that option if I were to do that. And I'm not saying we have to have a cycle lane from every house, you know, but having, you know, residential streets that are kinder to all modes of transport and not just about throughput for cars and people parking their cars, that would make a difference. And that's something, again, that I've been advocating for. And slower speeds is part of that too, right? You slow the speed down and it makes it a friendlier environment for people who are walking and cycling. The other thing, sorry, I know I'm going on a bit about this. The other thing is that the person who hit me with their car was dropping a child at school. Now, I don't know, we talked briefly on the day. I haven't talked to them since. I don't know their name or anything. So I don't know the choices that led them to feeling that driving their kid to school was the way to go. But if they had, you know, if their family was in a situation where that kid could get to school independently, they would simply not have been driving the car that way that morning. They would not have been, I suspect, in a little bit of a rush because I know what time that school starts because my kids have gone to that school. You know, that and made a mistake. So that's another, you know, next level sort of thing, that if we can create safer environments that mean that families feel that they can let their school kids, and this is an intermediate age kid, get to school independently, then that in turn will make our streets safer and, you know, have a really a virtuous cycle effect as well.
While you're here, I also wanted to talk a bit about Auckland's latest State of the City report. I was wondering if you'd had a look at it and what you would say should be Auckland Council's priorities in terms of improving the city on an international stage.
Yeah, I think one of the things that's interesting about this report is that one of the reasons that we're going backwards a little bit is actually because some of our peer cities are getting better. So, and we're not getting better at the same rate, or we are going backwards a little bit. And one of the things that I've taken out of it, and it's interesting because, you know, they release this every year, but actually they don't invite the councillors to attend. They invite the mayor, and he spoke, I understand. And obviously I couldn't have gone this year anyway. But, yeah, it's kind of weird to me that this is a conversation with everybody interested in the future of Auckland, and yet the councillors are not invited to participate in the release of it. But one of the key things that's coming through in it is that one of the issues that we're falling behind on in terms of the attracting talent and innovation and things like that is actually decarbonisation of our city, and that is having an impact internationally. We're seen as falling behind, and therefore that's affecting our rankings for this. And so that stuff that's around transport, so, you know, emissions, our biggest chance of tackling our emissions for Auckland is to reduce our transport emissions. So that's a transport question, but it's also a housing question, and they've identified that in the report too, that there's too much sprawl, which again increases emissions, and we're not being efficient enough about our land use, allowing more housing and more different types of housing close to jobs and education, close to good transport links, that kind of thing. So it's going to be really interesting to see next time they do the benchmarking, or in a few years' time, with some of the central government decisions around, for example, you know, allowing more intensification around the train stations in the inner west, whether that will help to shift the dial on some of that, because that is going to be something that indirectly, well, I think directly, but some people might see that as an indirect impact on decarbonisation. But hopefully we'll, you know, and some of the stuff it talked about, you know, we're losing that sense of people feeling like we're a safe, vibrant, I think the word they used was visceral, not quite sure what they mean by visceral, but, you know, the sort of dynamic, I guess, place to be, is that we know that those kinds of approaches to more intensification, transit-oriented developments around transport nodes like train stations does provide that vibrancy, that dynamism, that kind of stuff. So it'd be really interesting to see. I'm hopeful that those are some of the things that will shift the dials that we need, make Auckland a better place to live.
Yeah, just looking at the headlines this week, do you think it's a fair assertion to make that Auckland is falling behind in comparison with other cities?
I mean, one of the things, you know, on a national level that we're watching is that sort of there's a, you know, hollowing out of a lot of the public service, and there are actually a lot of public service jobs in Auckland. People moving overseas, you know, I mean, most of my husband's family live in Australia now. You know, a lot of people are experiencing that, people they know moving to Australia or moving out of Auckland because they can't afford housing here. So, you know, I think what the report identifies is real, and we've always had an issue where people have felt they needed to go overseas to get a level of experience that then allowed them to come back into New Zealand and do sort of the next tier jobs. But what we're seeing now is that we're losing people like teachers and nurses and people who didn't necessarily need that overseas experience to come back into more senior roles. They're going and they're not coming back because the pay is just not as good here. You know, they can't afford housing. Those kinds of things are driving people out. And unfortunately, we've seen that accelerate again recently. And all of that has a knock-on effect on the city, I think.
One of the, like you're talking about, one of the key issues or metrics that was discussed a lot with relation to this report was Auckland's productivity, especially since we are the largest city in New Zealand and we do carry a lot of that I suppose, responsibility as a city. How do you think that the council should work as a whole to improve Auckland's productivity?
Yeah, so productivity is, to be honest, a really hard one from a council perspective because so much of it is tied up in settings that are controlled by central government and decisions that are made in private business. I mean, we have got the regional deal coming, which gives us a platform to have some of those conversations, and also the mayor's leading a bid for one of the sort of, I think they're called Centres of Innovation or Centres of Excellence, to be based in Auckland, which, you know, I think is a no-brainer for central government. So there is some stuff happening, but there's also been a dismantling of some of the previous stuff that was happening through the Callaghan Institute, for example. And some of the innovation that actually Auckland could be at the forefront of is actually in the environmental space too. And we are seeing a retrenching, a withdrawal from a lot of that kind of work. So, the Predator Free, the company that was overseeing Predator Free is being wound up by central government. Some of the signals that they're sending at the moment about reform in the local government space seem to be withdrawing from environmental regulation, which is part of what potentially drives some of the innovation in that space, is to go, okay, how do we deal better with these kinds of regulations and rules? How do we, you know, for example, they're looking at potentially really weakening the regulations around drinking water. I mean, drinking water, come on, guys, like that's the stuff of life that needs to be safe. And so, you know, there's a whole lot of innovation, for example, that Watercare's been doing around water treatment and how do we potentially recycle water, how do we get toxins out of water. And, you know, like I've been out to one of their plants, we're actually selling some of that technology to the world. But if we're going to go, okay, well, we don't need as much environmental regulation, then why would people be excited to do that work? Why would they see the necessity? At the same time as we're moving away from blue skies research in our universities and research institutes as well, and defunding that kind of work, which again, you know, that blue skies stuff where you're just like, hey, you know, we haven't got a commercial outcome in mind, but we've got a, you know, an innovative idea to pursue. Those kinds of things just aren't going to happen anymore because they're not getting funded through central government. And so again, you know, those kinds of innovations are the things that hopefully result in productivity increases. And so we're making these short-term changes that aren't going to help with our long-term productivity goal.
That was Julie Ferry on road safety and Auckland's State of the City report. We'll be right back. Text in 5395 any of your thoughts on these pieces.
Have you tried mindfulness? Try mindfulness.
City Counselling on 95 BFM.
They say that fashion is art, and you, lovely listeners, are the canvas.
Merch. That's right. We've been in the lab designing some sexy new merch for you to stay hot when it's cold and cool as hell when it's hot.
We've got new tees, hoodies, the classic BSA slogan, and a limited edition t-shirt of BFM's iconic weatherman, Rick Breeze.
So run, don't walk, to twotonesmerch.co.nz and get your grubby little mitts on the hottest new 95 BFM merch.
Wallao Radio, 2 hours of music from Southeast Asia and its diaspora, complete with spicy takes, close inspections, interviews, and everything in between. Hey. She wanna man a slide, that's why she got that.
Wallao Radio, Monday nights, 11 p.m. to 1 a.m. Brought to you by your hosts, Otto and JC, only on 95 BFM.
Wallawe!
Once a week, on Saturday morning, a door in the 95 BFM studio appears. If you walk through that door, past the old posters, past the hanging vines, birds in their nests, and old 95BFM merch, you'll come to a waterfall. And at the top of that waterfall is the Saturday Spring.
The Saturday Spring with Karen Hay. Chats, tunes, and everything you need to dive into the weekend. Saturday mornings, 9 till 11. Only on 95BFM. Thanks to the Auckland Art Gallery. All I need is was to
be the
Welcome back to The Wire on 95BFM. That song is She's Back by Lee, featuring Finn Grieve.
Five, four, three, two, one.
International Desk are go.
Once a beacon of democratic progress, Georgia is at risk of sliding into authoritarianism, particularly due to Russian influence. Six opposition leaders face criminal charges, and the major opposition parties have been banned, while Georgia Dream, the political party in power, faces allegations of corruption and voter fraud. However, the party faces increasing opposition within Georgia, including mass protests over their pro-Russia laws. 82% of Georgians feel their country is in a crisis, with 78% directly citing the Georgian Dream political party as the cause. Wire host Caden spoke to Natasha Linstout, professor in the Department of Government at the University of Essex, about Georgia's anti-democratic crackdowns and public response. Here is that interview.
Can you summarize the key ways that Georgia's democracy is being eroded by Russian influence?
Well, there have been a lot of ways that it's been eroded. I think the biggest issue is it appears as if the ruling party, the Georgia Dream Party, either has coinciding interests with Russia or is being controlled by Russia, because Georgia seems to follow whatever Russia wants it to do. And this would go against what the public wants. Russia is not popular at all in Georgia. It's definitely a strong majority that do not like Russian influence. And in fact, further amount, around 80 to 90%, depending on the poll, want to join the European Union or want to look to be closer to Europe. And so with the party doing the opposite, that just shows how little the Georgia Dream Party is representing it. The other issue is these elections that take place aren't fair at all. I mean, there's different ways in which they're not fair. I mean, some of them, some people have accused the Georgia Dream Party of just engaging in blatant fraud, of like just stuffing ballots and so forth. But they buy votes, they intimidate the opposition, they imprison the opposition, they spy on the opposition. And then some of the more notable things that have happened, which have been due to Russian influence, is the adoption of the foreign agent law. Russia has been a pioneer of these foreign agent laws, where NGOs that are foreign have to declare themselves a foreign agent, and then they have to follow all kinds of bureaucratic hoops and fines, which makes it almost impossible for civil society and NGOs to operate. And then, of course, there are huge fines on protesters as well. There have been changes to the laws that affect free speech. So there's been a lot that has happened that shows how much Russia influences Georgia and has led to its autocratization.
What is the response to this been from the Georgian people? Have there been protests?
So Georgia has had a history of protests, even right after independence as well. They have a very vibrant and active civil society. And Georgians have always taken to the streets when they are frustrated, when they have had enough with corruption and authoritarianism. And so they constantly, particularly in Tbilisi in the capital, they constantly are protesting and participating in demonstrations. It doesn't matter if it's rain or shine. It doesn't matter if they're facing, you know, rubber bullets from the Georgian police. They're really brave and active. The issue is that the Georgia Dream Party, the regime, has become increasingly repressive, making it more difficult to protest without taking on huge risks.
Has the invasion of Ukraine impacted this relationship between Georgia and Russia in recent years?
So definitely, the Georgian public is completely supportive of Ukraine. And so when I visited Georgia a few years back, you would see there was all kinds of graffiti everywhere, very pro-Ukraine, very anti-Russian. There was a sign on a door and into a bookstore that said, and I saw a few of these signs, that you can't enter if you are Russian unless you denounced Russia's unlawful invasion of Ukraine. Since the war, and there was this huge mobilization effort where Putin wanted to mobilize 300,000 Russian men, there was just an influx of Russians coming into Georgia, which affected the housing market. It really caused the housing market to skyrocket. The nature of investment has changed as well. So you see that large Russian enterprises had to exit the market in Georgia, but you saw a huge rise in these smaller and medium-sized enterprises. It's hard to assess how much, but Russian oligarchic influence is probably really high in Georgia. And the other thing is that Georgia moved closer to Russia in terms of its foreign policy, though it didn't side with Russia officially. It didn't really condemn it either.
Should the European Union and other countries be paying attention to what's happening, or have they already?
So it's my understanding from interviewing many different Georgians who work at NGOs and so forth that they really rely on support both from the European Union and the US. And when that support is at its strongest, that has made it more difficult for the Georgia Dream Party to rapidly pursue autocratization. It slows things down at the very least. And I think that is important to pay attention to what's happened in Georgia, because Russia has sort of a blueprint here. I mean, they control 20% of their territory, and they have been trying to control more, just slowly a little bit more, going beyond what they had acquired in the past. And the way that they control Georgia is not just military, through military pressure. There's economic leverage. I mean, Georgia is very dependent on Russian oil and Russian liquefied gas. It's not dependent on Russian gas because it gets it from Azerbaijan, but some of these resources, this resource dependence that Russia has on countries, gives it tremendous economic leverage, gives it a lot of energy dependence. And there's also just the role of Russian intelligence and propaganda networks inside Georgia, which are extensive. I mean, Russia has invested in so much propaganda, disinformation, political influence, and intelligence penetration in Georgia. And they've already done this in Europe and parts of Europe where they feel that they need to do so. So they're able to undermine democracy by stoking polarization or by aligning with more radical right-wing parties or right-wing parties, populist parties in Europe. They did this as well with the Georgia Dream Party, which they completely have infiltrated. And they try to convey Russian ideas, pro-Russian narratives, or advance anti-Western narratives, or at the very least create confusion. And so this all, it's all a lot of fear-based messaging, maybe portraying Western engagement as a direct threat to Georgia's sovereignty. And they have other types of narratives that they promote within Western Europe and Eastern Europe as well.
You mentioned the role the United States plays in supporting Georgia. So I just want to finish by asking, does Trump's huge pullback on foreign policy make Georgia more vulnerable to Russian influence?
Oh, absolutely. And the U.S. itself is vulnerable to Russian influence because Trump, I know at the moment he's been critical of Putin, but Trump seems to be very easily manipulated by Putin. And the people that I interviewed working in NGOs in Georgia said it's very clear that U.S. support was instrumental in maintaining civil society, supporting NGOs, and helping promote democratic governance. When that support was wiped out, either because the administration stopped doing so, or because of a strategic reason, or because of a neglect, it really impacted small countries like Georgia that are really dependent on Western support to maintain their democracies and to keep democratic values alive. So the U.S.'s retreat from supporting democracy globally, bottom-up type of democracy, so I'm not talking about top-down measures, but when the U.S. has retreated from supporting bottom-up style democracy, it has a massive impact on countries like Georgia and beyond.
That was Natasha Lindstedt from the University of Essex on the backslide of democracy in Georgia, particularly due to Russian influence and the public response.
International Desk on 95BFM.
I don't kiss men.
The Wire.
But I kissed him.
Towards the start of this month, Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu nominated US President Donald Trump for a Nobel Peace Prize. I spoke to Tom Wilkinson, a PhD candidate in history at the University of Auckland, about Netanyahu's nomination, the Nobel Peace Prize in general, and his belief that there is an ulterior motive to the Israeli Prime Minister's nomination.
And I kind of approach this as an historian. So the Nobel Peace Prize obviously has this long, there is a kind of a long history of controversy in terms of nominees and sort of Nobel Peace Prize laureate. If you go back to kind of the 70s, you've got Henry Kissinger and Lee Duc Tho of North Vietnam nominated and win for negotiating a ceasefire in Vietnam, which was really controversial at the time because Kissinger himself, as part of the Nixon administration and before that when he was kind of a foreign policy advisor, kind of played both sides in terms of the way, you know, Kissinger kind of reported to Nixon on peace talks that were attempted in 1968. Kissinger supported increased bombing in Cambodia, started to champion it, even though he was personally against it when Nixon proposed it in the Vietnam War. And while he eventually then, you know, works on the ceasefire, there's a lot of controversy over, well, is it appropriate to award the Peace Prize to somebody who had done so much to kind of increase war and conflict in the region in the years prior? I would see the Trump sort of Peace Prize approach in a similar way. He's been nominated for it, but at the same time, you know, some political sort of commentators would argue that Trump has probably done a better job at increasing tensions in the region in the way that he's supported Netanyahu historically, and the way that he's kind of, you know, came out and bombed Iran as part of, you know, that 12-day conflict. And so to then be nominated for the Peace Prize because he helped supposedly helped negotiate a ceasefire kind of plays into that same perhaps hypocrisy that maybe emerges in this case. And there have been a number of commentators questioned about this in places like The Conversation. I think The Conversation ran a piece a few weeks ago where, you know, they asked, five experts were asked, and they all concluded, no, Trump should not win the Peace Prize because he doesn't deserve it. There's not peace in Gaza. There's not really peace in Iran because Trump's bombing actually exacerbated his decision from 2018 when he pulled out of nuclear negotiations. He's deployed the military against American citizens. He keeps threatening, you know, trade wars and annexation to US allies. He is not a force for peace is kind of the perspective that's coming out. So it seems absurd that he would be nominated for and subsequently win the Nobel Peace Prize.
Do you believe there is an alternative motive here?
Yeah, I do. When I kind of think about the Trump administration, the first Trump administration and this one, I kind of think back to a lot of online commentary I've seen, and I think some political commentators and perhaps Bob Woodward in his book about the first Trump administration may have mentioned this as well. There's this kind of atmosphere around Trump where, and, you know, people have said that he often responds well to, you know, praise or support. And, you know, if you praise him, you get in his ear and praise him, then he's more likely to support whatever you want to do. And that's where I do suspect this is a piece of political theatre from Netanyahu, where he's nominating Trump, and, you know, he does it, and he says in person to Trump, he's nominated and presents him with the letter. But at the same time, this is happening when Trump was expected to kind of talk to Netanyahu about a ceasefire for the war against Hamas in Gaza. And so it's perhaps a way of Netanyahu trying to get Trump's support for his goals, the continued invasion and occupation of Gaza, and, you know, the plans that Israel has laid out to force Palestinians into a camp in, you know, in the ruins of Rafah. And so it's one of those issues where it's perhaps not so much a serious attempt to get Trump a peace prize, but instead an attempt to get Trump support for whatever Israel, whatever policies Netanyahu wants to pursue in Gaza at this point in time.
In that light, does this move signal Netanyahu and Israel's sort of self-perceived lowering of support from Trump and the Trump administration?
I should couch this that I'm not a political commentator necessarily. I am an historian, but I do think that is part of what's going on here. Obviously, what kind of went around in the, we saw news reports in those kind of the days after Trump, you know, Trump announces he's secured a ceasefire between Israel and Iran, and conflict continued for a few more hours. And there were reports the next day, there was that, you know, quick interview with Trump that went around where he basically, he was furious. You could see him furious talking to the camera and basically going, hey, they don't know what if they're doing. You know, really lambasting both Israel and Iran. And I do wonder if that's something that, you know, Israeli policymakers saw and went, oh, okay, we might be losing support from him. So we need to, what can we do to try and shore that support back up? And that's where you get the Nobel Peace Prize nomination coming in. It seems like a, you know, perhaps a way of getting Trump's support again after doing something that kind of violated Trump's idea of what's, you know, right or what's appropriate, his idea of himself as a strong man who's able to negotiate these ceasefires. And you've seen it in the past couple of days as well, I think, with Trump claiming he's trying to get this ceasefire with Putin in terms of Ukraine, and Putin's kind of come out and gone no, and Trump's kind of lashed out a little bit at him as well in the past couple of days.
What is the likelihood that Israel would reap any benefits from this nomination of Trump?
To be honest, I'm not 100% sure. It's one of those things where it's, you know, it's possible that he may advocate for increased support to Israel and, you know, armed support, financial support, or he may be more willing to agree with what Netanyahu's, you know, and Israeli policymakers are trying to do. But at the same time, you've got that issue of, and this is something people have noted, Trump sometimes listens to the last thing that's, you know, put in his ear. So it may be that someone he trusts in his administration comes out and says, well, actually, maybe we shouldn't support this, and he might change his mind immediately. But this, to me, it does seem like this is something that could get greater support from Trump. And obviously, we've got, you know, comments from him in the past about turning Gaza into a, you know, the Monaco or something of the Middle East. This idea of turning it into, you know, the strip of casinos and hotels. And as much as that might be a kind of Trumpian comment of the absurd to try and generate discussion or make people ignore the other things the Trump administration is doing. It's also possible that this is something he genuinely believes is a solution to the problem of, you know, Israel and Palestine.
The Nobel Peace Prize will be awarded in December. What do you think we will see coming from the ceremony in light of this nomination? Should we expect protests?
I expect that there could be protests. I mean, the Peace Prize, obviously, there's often controversy around nominees, and there will be, I presume, other nominees who may actually be more deserving. But it's one of those things where it is, the Peace Prize, I think, is quite political. Obviously, you have individuals like Barack Obama who are nominated and win it. So Obama wins it in, I think, 2008-2009, right as his presidency begins. But then across his presidency, you know, there's criticism of the way that he increases US military strikes in the Middle East through drone strikes and so on. So there could be protests against the sort of Peace Prize, the ceremony. It's honestly, it's seen often there are protests at, you know, anything that Trump seems to be involved with, though I do think there may be some, but it kind of depends how seriously this nomination is taken at the end of the day. If it begins to look like Trump may actually receive it, or if you see other states or politicians coming out and nominating him. I mean, you've got Pakistan nominated him about, you know, kind of a month earlier or something like that. It may be that you get, you know, serious protests against the ceremony, but it does depend on, I think, who actually receives the prize.
That was the University of Auckland's Tom Wilkinson about Netanyahu nominating Trump for a Nobel Peace Prize.
You think you just fell out of a coconut tree?
The Wire.
We'll be right back.
Welcome back to the show. That was Viennes by Beck Runger.
So it's a very odd time to be alive, as they say.
The Wire.
A number of experts have raised concerns recently regarding the way too friendly relationship between alcohol industry lobbyists and policymakers responsible for alcohol restrictions and laws in New Zealand. While we have had an alcohol harm reduction levy in place for over 40 years, some experts, including University of Auckland School of Population Health Professor Peter Adams, believe that this levy isn't as positive as it seems. As alcohol lobbyists have been granted input and influence in the development of alcohol policies, Adams says that the levy is actually a smokescreen that allows the industry to profit from alcohol consumption without tangibly addressing its harms to the population. On Monday, producer Sam spoke with Professor Peter Adams about this topic. Here is that interview.
To start, as a broad question, what is the alcohol levy?
The alcohol levy is a levy that's put on consumption of alcohol, and that's done through through excise, so looking at how much is consumed legally in the country in terms of alcohol. So traditionally, it's been sort of hovering between $10 to $12 million a year over the last 30 years, but in the last year they increased it to $16 million a year. So they've been and that levy is a what I'd call a harm reduction levy. So it's a levy where you take money off the consumption for the purposes of dealing with the harm from those consumptions. Yeah. So it differs from other forms of levy, like the levy on, which is a levy to try and increase the product, or a levy that goes to a general health promotion or health fund.
Since the alcohol industry's lobbying at the Ministry of Health came to light, new rules of engagement for health officials had been announced. How much of an impact will these rules have on mitigating future conflicts of interest?
Well, this is the area that I research in, and the area we call it, the WHO calls it, or the World Health Organization calls it, commercial determinants of health. And over the last, say, 10 years, there's been a huge increase in research in this area. And what we're particularly interested in is how unhealthy commodity industries like alcohol, tobacco, food and gambling are able to promote industry-friendly policy. How do they achieve that? And the main thing is they achieve it by forming influential relationships with policymakers, particularly politicians. So that's what I've been very interested in, is how this is achieved. So we've been interviewing a lot of politicians and government officials about the ways in which relationships are built between industry representatives and government actors. So yeah, it's a big area, not just in New Zealand but also internationally, and it's part of a whole range of things happening. I mean, I guess what my response would be that we have to sort out so many other things if we're going to start cleaning up the house, if you like.
What are we seeing regarding how the alcohol industry is regulated?
Well, I think what matters here, and I don't know if you've looked at the Health Coalition Aotearoa, that's where people involved with population and public are getting together and trying to pull our thinking. One area that we're really concerned about is the way lobbyists work. So lobbyists come in various forms. There is a third-party lobbyist who has many clients, who works on building relationships with government actors. But there's also the industries themselves have their public government relations people. There's also trade associations like the Food and Grocery Council who also lobby. We have virtually no constraints on lobbying in New Zealand. So we're kind of like an open season. Compare us to other similar countries. We seem to be completely devoid of any kind of restraints on how our industry works with government actors.
So why do we have so few regulations on lobbying?
It's been happening like this for a long time. The industries themselves are influential, so they can pretty much influence whether or not any sort of constraints are put in. What we're suggesting as a starting point is that there should be a lobbying register, that there should be a stand-down period between when a politician or other people move from their roles, such as a parliamentary reporter, into being a lobbyist, because that happens with almost immediately. So people with very strong relationships within government are able to trade on those and become lobbyists and help industry form close relationships in Parliament. We also say there should be some form of, and I think this is particularly important, some point of accountability, because there isn't a real point of accountability. And if we were to introduce a code for lobbyists, we would need an organisation with independence. So some places, like in Ireland, they've set up the equivalent of an integrity commission, or a point at which the integrity of relationships is monitored and policed, and the sort of practices that are happening now are being challenged. So these you'll find on the Health Coalition Aotearoa, there is a move to try and push some of these changes into the government sector. At the moment, it's pretty tough, but I think over time, particularly when you get revelations like Guyon just got with seeing direct relationships between government officials and the alcohol industry, when you get more and more of that happening, we do need to really think about tightening up and improving the way in which we handle conflicts of interest and undue influence within government.
During Jacinda Ardern's first term, then National Party leader Simon Bridges was caught breaking campaign financing rules. But Ardern said our system needed no changes. What does this say about both major parties?
Yes, both major parties don't toe the line when it comes to looking at the integrity of what's going on. Yeah, it's sort of all part of the problem, because industry has built strong relationships within government, and therefore they don't. Both sides of the equation are benefiting to some extent, and no one wants to rock the boat in those spaces. There was a attempt by the previous government to look at lobbying more closely, and the Justice Department started a review, but that's been shelved, and the only thing I think that's coming out of it, or probably will come out of it, will be a voluntary code of conduct for lobbyists. But I think the history of voluntary codes is that they're often there for pressing than for really making a difference of what's going on. So at the moment, there's not a lot happening, and both parties seem reasonably happy to let it carry on as it does.
What would you like to see changed about the alcohol levy?
With the alcohol levy, my view is that we shouldn't have one. I've been involved with both the alcohol and the gambling levy for most of the time that they've been around. I about 20 years ago, I started to realise what was going on and pulled away from funding from them. It's an unusual arrangement. Other countries haven't got harm reduction levies. There's maybe Thailand, Korea had one for a while. Vic Health in Australia had one for a short period from tobacco. The problem is that what happens is that the levies are put into reducing harm, but it's usually the reduction is harm is there more for appearance than anything. And it tends to go not in the direction of public health, but more in the direction of individualised approaches, alcohol awareness, campaigns, etc., which really favour the industry. And in fact, many other countries around the world have what they call industry front groups that fund things like drink driving campaigns, youth drinking, alcohol awareness campaigns. And the industry fund them themselves for two reasons. The first reason is to make it look as if they're doing something about what the harm that their product does. And the second reason is to make sure that people attribute the problems to individuals, not to the product or the systems in which they're sold. So they're willing overseas to invest millions and millions in setting up exactly what our government's setting up with the levy. But it's a smokescreen that firstly pretends that something's been done, and secondly that pushes things in the direction of individualised approaches, which we know not to be effective. I mean, one of the areas that in the 40 years I've been involved with alcohol, when I first started, the research was already there that alcohol education was ineffective. And yet 40 years later, we're still putting money into alcohol education through schools and other programs. And the research has just got stronger and stronger in terms of effectiveness, rather than looking at the real key drivers for change, which are pricing, availability, and constraints on marketing. The industry's been very successful in using these programs to divert attention from what really makes a difference. Sorry, that was a long explanation.
What needs to change so that alcohol companies cannot have so much sway in alcohol regulation in the country?
Well, again, it goes back to how they connect with the politicians. And we need to have stronger measures that restrict that influence. I think, again, like the step-down period, a register, an integrity monitoring body, all those things are key to reducing the extent that, or the freedom that industry has to influence policy making more than the public has, so that the public have less influence than the industry itself, which is what really is sort of essential to a democracy, I think, is that the public have a stronger say than industrial influences.
That was my final question. Is there anything you would like to add?
We teach in this area a lot. We have courses on it. We have quite a bit of research. In fact, a lot of my colleagues are doing it in different areas, and some are doing it looking at the influence of the food industry. Others are looking at tobacco industry and vaping. And others, like myself, are looking at alcohol and gambling and the way in which those industries influence policy making. So it's a pretty important part of public health. And our school has quite a number of people who are active in research in this space.
That was University of Auckland Professor of Population Health, Peter Adams, on alcohol industry lobbying and the ineffectiveness of the alcohol levy.
The Wire. That was The Wire.
Ko ira te hōtaka katoa mō tēnei wiki, nei te mihi ki a koutou katoa I korido mai ki maua mō tēnei rā. That's a wrap on The Wire for Rāpiti Thursday. Nei ra hoki te mihi ki a koutou e whakaronga ana, thank you for tuning in. Thank you to everyone who spoke with us today, Labour's Shannon Halbert, Councillor Julie Ferry, The University of Essex's Natasha Linsat, the University of Auckland's Tom Wilkinson, and Peter Adams. You're listening to 95 BFM. Next up is the 1 to 4 with Sophia.
That was a 95BFM podcast. Support 95BFM with a B-card. Go to 95BFM.com/signup.